Okay, it is a tremendous bliss to be able to have the first official Parsha Shir of the official school year. And this year we are learning Revi. So Parsha's Re'eh has quite a few fascinating topics throughout. But the fourth Aliyah especially, or particularly, is one that we have a lot we can consider and talk about, and maybe we would have missed because there's so much to talk about in the rest of the parsha. So it's a special schus for us to be able to look at this fourth Aliyah of Re'eh, which you may have noticed is actually framed in a very specific way. And there is a theme of Kedusha that goes throughout. And we find that already invoked in the second pasuk and the last pasuk, which is itself interesting. But the very first idea is the theme of God being our Father. Banim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem. So that is the opening line of the Aliyah. And the Medrash is actually a machlokus about this, that according to the opinion of Rabbi Yehuda, who in general, the Gemara tells us, he is one who is Darish Smuchim, that he pays attention to what psukim are next to each other and what you can derive from that. So Rabbi Yehuda says that the message here is that the previous pasuk in the end of the first Aliyah tells us that we have to listen to God. He's Tishma b'kol Hashem Elokecha, l'shmor es kol mitzvosav v'sharnochi mitzavcha yom, v'asota yashuv ein Hashem Elokecha. That's the end of the previous Aliyah that we're picking up from. So according to Rabbi Yehuda, we should pay attention to the juxtaposition, and we should say, okay, so that's the story. You do all that, you follow God's rules, then banim atem l'Hashem Elokechem. Then you are considered His children. Otherwise, not so simple. It's all contingent. And Reb Meir disagrees. And the Mishnah Chachma has a comment over here where he brings a proof to Reb Meir's position that we understand that, yes, we are expected to follow God's rules and to listen to Him, and that's what we're here for. But we are Banim L'Hashem regardless. We are His children anyway, and we maintain the relationship. And even when we stumble, we plan to come back, and He continues to love us and give us that family connection that we're able to build on, so that even when we are not exactly perfect, we still maintain that relationship. We are still children to God. So in that context, so we are told that there are prohibitions that reflect that. So what is going on in the rest of the pasuk? Los is go to do, velos asimu karcha b'nechem l'meis. So on the surface, in the literal translation, the pasuk is telling us that how do you react if somebody, God forbid, passes away? So apparently, the culture of the time was very extreme reactions. People would pull out their hair and would cut their skin in reaction to grief. And the Torah is telling us that that's not permissible. That's not the way we do things. We're not allowed to react that way. And in that context, we're told, Banim atem l'Hashem Elokeichem. A question about that?
It seems like from that context, though, you're allowed to do it outside of the parameters.
So that's an interesting question also. So the connection is, so we also find that l'halacha, that if you have this reaction to some other kind of negative situation that's not a ptira, so then you're not chayv malchus. Interesting that the focus is specifically on this situation, even though it's probably an isser without that. A lot of details that are somewhat ambiguous. So, for example, when it comes to pulling out hairs, so are we talking about only creating a visible gap? Is that the issue? Or are we talking about any kind of pulling out hairs? Or is that what we call a chatzi shir? Is that a little bit of the isser, but it doesn't really tap into the actual issue at hand? So there's a lot to relate about that, and particularly when we talk about this question of if it's connected to a mace only. So the context of the pasuk saying that that's the reaction to a mace that you're not allowed to have. So is that the whole thrust of it, or does it apply also to other contexts like you're asking? So we do find that you're only chayv malchus specifically in the context of mace, but it's probably usher anyway. So the idea of the reaction to grief seems to be part of the focus here. And Rav Hirsch, for example, in his commentary over here, he understands that if you perceive that you are children of God, and that that is the nature of your existence on this earth, that your key relationship is with God, as important as your relationship with human beings is, but you can't come to the perspective that if, Chalila, a person who you love passes away, that your world has ended, that you're just totally bereft and that there's nothing left, and that you're going to have very extreme reactions. So that idea of banim is meant to emphasize that, okay, so it's a terrible thing that happened, but you still have your relationship with God. Life is not over. And to understand that and appreciate that, that's perhaps what's being highlighted. Now, what's perhaps of more practice to us, because I think we're not inclined to do these things, but the Gemara tells us, as you got a chance to see, if you saw the Gemara in Yevamos and elsewhere, that there is an extra prohibition that is derived from here. And according to most, this is a prohibition min ha-Torah as well. You might think it's an asmachta. You might think that the limud here, the derivation, is not necessarily so obvious, and perhaps it isn't. But nonetheless, many understand that this is a din min ha-Torah, that not only are we prohibited to make these cuts on our body, but it's not just about body, it's also about the national corpus, so to speak. It's about the national body, and therefore we can't cut our physical selves, nor shall we cut our social selves. So to create what the Gemara calls agudos, agudos, factionalism, to break up into smaller groups, that is itself a prohibition. And the Gemara in Yevamos understands that to mean, you saw the Gemara in Daf Yugimel and Daf Yudalid, so the Gemara understands that to mean different halachic practices within eyeshot, within that which can be perceived. So it's a machlokus in the Gemara, what qualifies as that which can be perceived? Does it mean different bate din within one city are having overtly different practices? Or does it mean that within one bezdin there are split practices? So that's a matter of debate in the Gemara. But essentially that's the principle that emerges, that we can't have different halachic practices in a visible way. And some of the commentaries explain, the Ritva is a comment over here, others have discussions connecting this again to the language of Banim Atem LaHashem. So some point out that both of these concepts are connected to the theme of Banim Atem LaHashem, that we are all the Father, we are all the sons of one Father, we are all connected to one God, so therefore we don't want to look like we have divergent practices. That's going to call into question that connection. And similar to what we said before, that also the idea of not cutting yourself is also a connection to that idea, that we're not going to react in such an extreme way to grief, because we understand that we are ultimately connected to God. The Netziv in his commentary here has an interesting point, that he thinks there basically are two themes, that here there is Barim Atem L'Hashem Elokeichem, that it starts off here, and then the next pasuk, which continues with a key, seems to be connecting it to the previous pasuk, so Ki Am Kadosh Ata, because you are holy. So therefore, that's the reason. So which is it? Is that we're holy, or is it that we are God's children? And he suggests that it reflects the fact that we have essentially here two Isurim that both come from the same pasuk, and that are both considered in HaTorah. He emphasizes that, in his opinion, it's not Asmachta. These are both derived equally from this pasuk, and therefore each one needs its own introduction. So we have the prohibition of cutting ourselves in grief, and the prohibition of making separate groups. And that one is introduced perhaps by Banim Atem L'Hashem Elokeichem, the idea that we shouldn't act in an extreme and disconnected way. That reflects the fact that we are a holy nation. So there is a lot to discuss about the prohibition of loses go to do. It's one that has many implications in practice, and it's not so simple to know how exactly to apply it. And part of the question is, what exactly is it about? So it seems to be a machlokas rishonim. Rashi, in his commentary to Yevamos, seems to understand that the issue is one of looking like there's two Torahs. It shouldn't look like there are two different guiding systems for us, and that itself is a problem. Some understand that that's a problem with the Chilul Hashem, or maybe it's itself somewhat idolatrous. It seems to suggest that there are different sources of authority that are guiding us. So that's how Rashi is apparently understanding that there's a concern. It shouldn't look like there are two Torahs, and that would be the impression that's created if we had visibly different halachic practices. While others, such as the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch, like we mentioned yesterday, that we'll see that very often they are connected in the same camp, the Rambam and the Sefer Achinuch understand that the issue was one of machlokas. that if we're going to have different things going on in the same circle, so that's going to lead to people fighting. So does it matter which interpretation it is? So that there's a lot of literature on, and many suggest, and Itziv has this discussion in his Tshuvas, Itziv has a lot to say about this. So we mentioned a minute ago his commentary on Chumash here. He also talks about this in the Tshuva in the Meshuv Davar, and in his commentary to the Gemara in Yevamos, Lamarom Meisad, he talks about it there also. So one of the points that he brings out, and that there's a lot of literature about, is the question of Minhagim. So should there be a prohibition of losis godudu when it comes to things that are not about halacha per se in its original source, but when it comes to minig? So the assumption that they have, many of the achronim who talk about this, is that this connects to this issue, that if the issue is we don't want to look like there's two Torahs, so people understand that when it comes to minig, so minhagim develop differently in different communities and maybe in different families. And therefore, the fact that people are doing different things to reflect different practices is not going to create a machlokas per se. But it's not going to create, rather, the apparent appearance of two Torahs. But maybe it will create a machlokas. That's the objection, that when it comes to concerns about what will cause a fight, so as we know, people are able to fight about anything. Maybe they fight about Minhagim more than they fight about Dinim and HaTorah. So if you're going to have a variance in Minhagim within Aishat, so the concern is maybe that will create Machlokas. So that was a significant Machlokas, significant literature, about the question of how do we apply Losis Godudu and Minhagim. There are all kinds of areas in which it comes up. One of the most blatant cases, Rav Moshe Feinstein has the Tshuva, where he notes it's severely problematic. Well, we see all the time in America over Chol HaMoed. So we have a Chol HaMoed coming up now in 5 weeks. So what about tefillin? So as we know, some wear tefillin and some don't wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed. And the question of having a shul where some are doing one and some are doing the other, so that seems to be a problem of losis godudu. And the poskim were very concerned about this. In America, it is often tolerated. In Eretz Yisrael, as you may know if you spent time in Eretz Yisrael and Yantif, it is not tolerated. So there the policy is, at least in public, there's no tefillin on Chol HaMoed. And when it comes to America, so you find more of a mixture of Minhagim, and that mixture is a question. So how do we tolerate that in light of Losis Godudu? So that itself is a discussion. Some argue, in fact, that it can't be tolerated. That's the problem. And it may have to do with some level of acceptance. Interesting, this question, to be precise about language, so the question of tefillin on Chol HaMoed is not really a question of minig. We relate to it as a minig kind of thing, because, okay, different families and different segments of Judaism, there are different practices, but really it's a halachic question. It's an issue of, do we understand that we're supposed to wear tefillin on Chol HaMoed or not? How do we understand the concept of oaths, the concept of Chol HaMoed? So really, it's a halachic question, which different individuals will have different attitudes to. So it's not really an issue of minig, but the way we colloquially use minig, it's kind of taken on that kind of meaning. Last year we spoke about minig and its proper definition application at the beginning of Bava Basra. So some of the svaras may help here, because the question of whether minig should have a prohibition of losis godudu or not, so it really depends on what we mean by that, and it really depends on what kind of minhagim. So for example, the Steich Emet points out that the differences between Sephardi and Ashkenazi minhagim are so long-standing and so entrenched that presumably, hopefully, there's a certain degree of mutual respect and understanding. And we understand, okay, so Sfarim do things one way, Ashkenazim do things another way. That's not necessarily a reason to get into a fight. So there's a lot of subjectivity here. But the whole question of how to assess what's a long-standing minig, what's not a long-standing minig, what is going to be understood as reflecting different practices. So that's a part of the literature here. So when it comes to the tefillin question, maybe that's an element also, that even though there are many and the entire culture and arts as well, this is not an acceptable situation to have different practices here, but to whatever extent it is, perhaps it's perceived as something roughly in the minig category, even though it's not necessarily the right precise way to determine it. But it seems to be it's understood as something, okay, you have a family practice way, I have a family practice that way, and we don't necessarily have to fight about it. So that's a whole discussion how exactly to apply this and how not to apply this. And the Netziv has this tshuva, as we mentioned, and the Sridi Eish has a long tshuva where he critiques the Netziv's tshuva, and he suggests that there's different dinim here, that there is, on the one hand, losis godadu, which has its parameters, but when it comes to minhagim, there's another component, the Gemara in Maseches Pesachim, which as Perek in Pesachim called makom shenagu. And there the Gemara talks about the idea of al yishana adam minhaminag mishum machlokis, that a person should not deviate from that which is done locally because it causes machlokis. So there, that may be a din d'rabbanan on top of losis godadu, but it reflects the idea that there is a significant concern of creating machlokas when there's a deviation from minig. But there, what it's really referring to is there is a place that has a local minig. So therefore, there is a practice that is associated with that territory, and to deviate from that is going to cause tension in that place, which is one of the major sugyas that's relevant to where it comes up over there. It's relevant also to the idea of Yontif Sheni and the fact that in Eretz Yisrael there's no Yontif Sheni, and as far as there is, that's very relevant to addressing that question. And then the more modern issue, because of the ease of travel of when one is in one place or the other, how exactly that should be practiced. So that's very much connected to this issue that we're not supposed to, at least publicly, deviate from whatever the minig is in a certain place, and whether that's a drabanan, a new creation, or whether that is a reflection of the existing iser of losis godadu. So that's somewhat of a debate, but we do find that to whatever extent there is an acceptance of the existence of more practices, so that plays a big role in determining how exactly this is played out, when it's an issue and when it's not an issue. The Rishonim, as you saw, that comes up in the Maseches Yevamos, and also the Rishonim in the beginning of Megillah, try to figure it out, because the first Mishnah in Megillah talks about various days for reading the Megillah. That nowadays we read the Megillah on 2 days, the 14th and the 15th of Adar, but according to the first Mishnah in Megillah, there were other days also, that the villages, the farms, had the extra flexibility to read the Megillah on the Monday or Thursday before, and then the Rishonim try to figure out how they were doing that. Were they doing that in their own villages? And if so, how did it help them? Why couldn't they just then read the Megillah whatever day it should be? So it sounds like they were coming into the big cities and reading the Megillah on a different day from whatever that city would have been doing. So the Rishonim discuss how is that acceptable in terms of losis godadu, and how do we work this out, and how could you have this overt practice in a way that contradicts what is going on there otherwise? Isn't that a issue of losis godadu? So there's a lot to figure out. There's a lot that is analyzed in terms of the applicability of losis godadu, and it does boil down a lot to the details. But there are some who emphasize that it's worth noting that the prohibition of machlokes is a prohibition that's a serious one in the Torah. We have a lot of possible sources as to what the Isser of Machlokas is. So the idea that emerges from the Rambam in the Sefer HaChinuch, that it sounds like Losis Godadu is a source for Machlokas, is particularly meaningful because as the Gemara applies it in the context of halachic practice, so it's very instructive to note that even when coming from the perspective of halachic practice, we still have to be mindful of the issue of machlokas, that it's not that just because we're dealing with halacha, we can say, right, everything gives, and there's no problem with machlokas, machlokas l'shem shamayim, so there's nothing to worry about. We see very much not that way. And the Netziv mentions in his writings that if we were to take the position that losis godadu doesn't allow even for a change in minhagim, so that would be particularly significant because he works off the premise that minhagim are binding on us because of what we call divrei kabbalah, because of the pasuk in Nach, al titosh tara simecha. That means there's actually a chiyuv to stick with the practices of our family, and yet nonetheless the prohibition machlokas is going to overweigh that, it's going to outweigh that, it's going to override that. And that's instructive itself as far as understanding just how much of a role machlokes and its prohibitions play. So a lot to say about this, and that's one of the major themes that opens up the Aliyah here, and then it goes on to everything else. It goes on to tell us essentially all of the rules of kashrus. Did you have a question about that?
Yeah, I mean, actually, it's a good segue into kashrus, but
okay.
Is that like hechsherim? Is that what, anyway, like loskodu, like machlokes?
Yeah. Certainly can create a lot of machlokes. People have to be very, very careful about how they deal with such issues and to be connected to what an issue is and what isn't an issue. And something that Rosh Hashanah Zalman emphasized in his Tshuvas also, that when it comes to Shalom issues and kashrus, you have to be aware of what's a real issue, what's not an issue, what's a chumrah, what's just a matter of different practice. It takes a lot of sensitivity, so it's very interesting. It's a good point to highlight the smichas aparshias here, so to speak, that the whole rest of the aliyah is basically about what you can and can't eat. And the idea that it opens up, it's a That's very good ha'ara, it's a very interesting ha'ara that it opens up with Losis Kodidu as a message. Basically, the whole Aliyah is set up with almost everything is about kashrus, but first there's this din of Losis Kodidu. So that's a fascinating point to think about. That maybe it's kind of a warning that, okay, this is very important. The principles of kashrus, as we know, one of the major identifying features of Judaism, and yet at the same time, so we're still told that losis kodidu. We have to be careful. We have to make sure not to engage in machlokas. And it's an interesting question how we paskin on this issue about whether it's about machlokas or about shtei torahs. Rav Moshe Halberstam in his Tshuvas to Rav Moshe has a tshuva where he says it doesn't have to be one or the other. It's very possible that we paskin like both, but that would mean that we have chumras of both. Perhaps, but son-in-law also has a tshuva along these lines. Son-in-law is Rav Matisyahu Deutsch, wrote a sefer called Nesivas Adam, where he takes a similar approach, and he says it could be that we are worried about both. We're worried about creating two Torahs, and we're worried of the image of two Torahs, and we're worried about the reality of machlokes. But still, there could be exceptions. It still could be that if you have a practice that is entrenched for many centuries and it's understood that there are different ways of doing things, to whatever extent there is some kind of mutual acceptance, so that probably goes a long way. So when it's something that's not a matter of absolute halachic practice, and it's something that is able to be reconciled with people getting along peacefully, so then that still gives us room to be makel on that, even if we accept both. It's a fascinating discussion in the commentary of Rav Hirsch. He goes on to discuss just how much halachic unity has been crucial to the communal unity, the idea that we know we welcome differences of opinion in the development of halacha, but we also had a process by which there comes to be a conclusion. So therefore, practice is still supposed to be unified. And as he discusses there, for about 1,200 years, for a long time, going into the period of the second Beis HaMikdash, there was essentially unity in practice for most things, that there was a system of figuring out what the conclusion is going to be and how to behave, so there shouldn't be a visible pirud. And it was only after that point, in the middle of the Second Temple period and then the Churban, that things started to fall apart, and there was a disconnection between Jews and between each other and between Talmidim and their Rebbeim, and it was harder to translate things into some kind of unified practice. And then he notes that the writing down of the Mishnah and what Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi did in order to bring everything together, which from the Gemara we understand that to be out of the concern just of the Torah being forgotten, that the Torah Shebaal Peh was supposed to be oral until there was a concern that it was going to get forgotten and therefore it was written down. So here Hirsch highlights a different goal of writing it down. It wasn't just the writing it down, but it was also the creating of a more formal process for everything to come together and to be decided, because that was necessary for the unity of Klal Yisrael. And then Ravina and Ravashi in editing the Gemara did their part in that effort. It's parallel to an idea that we also find in next week's Parsha. So we'll read about Lo Sasser, that we're not supposed to deviate from rabbinic instruction. And it's a big discussion, does that apply even if there's some reason to think that the rabbinic instruction is a mistake? Let's say if you have some basis to believe that the psak that you're getting is an error, so is there a reason still to be bound to lo sasa, you shouldn't deviate from that psak? That was a big machlokes, it's not our topic now, but it's interesting that those who felt that there was a need to do so connected it also to this idea of there has to be a unified Klal Yisrael, that there has to be a approach in psak so that we can not have everyone following whatever they think is right, but there has to be a path in Klal Yisrael to be able to create a cohesive picture, and therefore, even if there might be a significant concern that a certain psak is an error, so it's still worth, that's the way they say it for Achinuch sound, a few other sound, that it's worth tolerating a few errors in the system for the sake of that kind of unity, which is a fascinating thought, and seems to correlate to this idea here also, that we're finding that the Din of Losis Godudu tells us that even you're sure your opinion is right, but you're going to have to be mevatel your das to the larger psak, because the need of a cohesive practice takes priority even over, like we said before, minhagim, but even more than that, even deciding dinam daraisa is going to be connected to this concern of losis godu. Okay, but that's all back to that. But now to get to kashrus, and again, you did, you thank you for that point. It's an interesting idea that this kind of frames the whole discussion of kashrus, and it is unfortunate that b'sman hazeh, there's a lot of period about it and a lot of painful divisions sometimes about policies within kashrus, and we do what we can to try to keep that on the same page as much as possible, and it's an interesting way of framing it. You wanted to add to that?
I mean, just, if I could ask, unless you want to go back there.
Go for it.
But just in terms of like nowadays, like different, you know, socio-religious sects within Judaism, is that a violation of Los Escondu between, you know, modern Orthodoxy, Yeshivish, Hasidish, you know, Chabad even, like, is that, how does that fall into...
On the one hand, really on both hands, you know, we embrace diversity, and that is certainly a part of the whole hashkafa we have of all the different gates and the different shvatim, and that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created all of us unique and with our own perspectives, because there are many different ways to serve Him and to appreciate His word and to filter it through our unique understanding and perspectives, and that's considered to be a big part of the strength of Klal Yisrael. It can turn out to be connected in a way and processed in a way that causes machlokes that is unhelpful, and that's unfortunate, and it's a careful balance. And if you remember correctly, the Shem Shmuel has a comment along these lines that in Parshas Devarim we read a few weeks ago, but it feels like it was a lifetime ago because it was before Tisha B'Av, so we have that major shift in mentality between before and after Tisha B'Av. We read Devarim always before Tisha B'Av, and we read the pasuk that Eicha Esal Levadi. Moshe Rabbeinu says, how can I handle everybody by myself? And we read that in the tune of Eicha. Not just it has the word, but it has also the tune of Eicha. And the Shem Yishmuel was the son of the Avnei Nezer. In his commentary, so he notes that it's surprising that we treat this as a tragic kind of pasuk, and we read it with that tune, because the Gemara says that that was a reference to a time of great bounty and great success, and the diversity of Klal Yisrael is really a strength. So yes, we have all kinds of differences and all kinds of unique aspects to us, but that's something that should be a source of power for the Jewish people. So I believe he suggests that that's the point, that the fact that what should be a strength of the Jewish people is processed as a source of fighting and a source of strife, that's what Tisha B'Av is about. And that ideally we're able to process our differences in a positive way, and we're able to gain from the different perspectives that we each bring to the table. And that should be something that is fantastic. But because it unfortunately translates into our intolerance, which is something the Nesiv talks about himself in great detail in his Hakdama to Bereishis and elsewhere, that he understands that that was what Churban was about, that we couldn't tolerate the fact that others see things differently and worship God through their own perspective. So that lack of tolerance, he writes, was the source of the Churban. So it all becomes a matter of degree. Yeah, we need to be able to find where that sweet spot is, essentially, to be able to appreciate that, yes, diversity is a very powerful resource and could be the source of great strength, but we also need to have a coherent path and practice. So how exactly to navigate that, and how to know when there can be differences in practice that don't break that unity, is itself a tricky balance. And perhaps if it were an easier question, we wouldn't still be in Galus. But the fact that it's a balance that takes a long patch of history to try to figure out exactly how to harmonize is perhaps the issue. So the din of Los Escotidu is kind of a snapshot of that. Shows that, yes, we have many different opinions going in, we have many different perspectives, many different attitudes, and how to navigate that without it creating machlokas is essentially what Los Escotidu is warning us of, that there's always the potential of fighting that causes serious period in the community. There's the potential of creating the impression that we're serving different gods, that it's different Torahs. And at the same time, like we're seeing from many of the poskim in terms of why there might be differences in terms of Minhagim, that theoretically there could be a culture that also could tolerate that. So how exactly you create that harmony is a part of the challenge, is a part of what exactly we're looking for. And as you also noted, so that's a major problem when it comes to kashrus. Now kashrus, of course, how we eat together is one of the major social connections that we have. So the idea of keeping society together is greatly impacted by these rules, and also the whole nature of Kedusha is greatly impacted by this sense of discipline. So that's a part of the question, how to relate to the whole rules of kashrus, which are basically all reviewed here in this Aliyah, even though they were taught already in Parsha Shemini. And there's a lot to figure out. So, for example, Lo Sochol Kol Toeva. So here, this is kind of an introduction. You shouldn't eat anything that is disgusting. So it's a major machlokas rishonim as to what this refers to. It's referred to some specific iser separate from everything that's detailed in the rest of the Aliyah. Or is this a way of saying, in general, anything that is objectionable, we understand that we have a prohibition of eating. So there are some who understand that basa b'chalav, which comes at the end of the Aliyah. So there's an opinion in the Gemara that that's also included in this pasuk, that the creation of basa b'chalav is a toeva, is something that is problematic, is abominable, and therefore for that reason we're not supposed to eat it. So there's a lot of range to interpret what exactly is the focus of this pasuk specifically, but it certainly serves as an introduction to telling us that there are things that we're not allowed to eat. And then it goes on to say, Zosa behema asher tochelu. So here's what you are allowed to eat, and it lists a lot of animals, which is a question the Chasam Sofer talks about in Achuva, and what exactly this represents, because when it comes to behemos, at least, so we have klalim, we know there are rules as to how to identify what's kosher and what isn't. So why the Torah has to then list all the animals that are kosher is itself a question that the Chasam Sofer and the Ksav Kabbalah and others struggle with. And there's a specific focus here on the most famous non-kosher animal, the chazir, the pig, which has come to symbolize all kinds of non-kosher food. Chazir treif is the worst kind of treif you can have. But it's interesting because maybe this is a part of it, but as the pasuk tells us, that the chazir has one of the simanim and not the other. And some suggest that that's what makes it so bad, that it's able to be deceptive, it's able to fool you into thinking it is a kosher animal while it isn't. Question about that?
I mean, there seems to be other ones that also have one
someday. Yeah, the chazir still represents... It's a good question of itself, why that should be highlighted more. I think it's also the fact that it just is a more prevalent type of food that we come up against the system more often, so we have to deal with it, so it's come to represent that. You want to comment on that?
I mean,
I guess a separate question. Mm-hmm. If we were able to ever like genetically modify a pig to start chewing its cud, would then be kosher?
Oh, so that's a great question on a lot of levels, because first of all, more than we can discuss in this short slide, might be a good Sunday topic, but the whole question of genetic modification has a lot of nafkaminas, because first of all, so as the Achronim discuss, you know, are these the reasons or these clues? Siva or simen, you know, basically the animal's not kosher because it doesn't have these simanim, or that's a way to identify the animal that's not kosher in and of itself. So even without genetic modification, you could theoretically have an animal that may be an anomaly somehow and may have the simanim and yet still be from a clearly identified non-kosher species, which may also address the question of the Chasam Sofer, why they're still listed. So that itself is already a question, and that goes to a lumdish issue, essentially, simen siva, is this the reason it's not kosher, is how you know it's not kosher, and that also could affect the question then if you could intentionally create animals that will be different as far as the simanim, how that should play out. And nowadays there are all kinds of other ways to create food in the laboratory that may come from the cell of an animal or may not, and that's going to have major ramifications also for how exactly to perceive it. So there's a whole world out there that has yet to be decided to a certain extent in terms of the kashrus of food that is created with that kind of manipulation. So when it comes to chazer, it's also interesting, there's also a separate discussion, but as much as this is the paradigmatic non-kosher food, there is also possibly a medrash, say possibly, because there is some debate as to whether this is a real medrash. It's quoted in some psalm. It's quoted in a lot of psalms, so there's a lot of back and forth as to whether it's an actual medrash or not. But there is a suggestion that the language of Chazir reflects the fact that asid lachzirun liyisrael, that there will come a future when pig will actually be kosher. And does that reflect, as you're suggesting, maybe because they will have different simon, they'll be physically different, or is there something else to that? Is it even true? There's a lot of literature about that, and that's maybe a good Sunday topic also to get more into it, but there's a lot that could be opened up by that discussion. Debbie?
Following his question, if you genetically modify, let's say, a pig, is it still considered a pig at that point?
That's also the question. So how do we define it?
Thieves.
Right, so how do we, what if it comes to it? So if you have an animal that's born of a pig, so then you have yotzei min ha'iser, should it be defined by the parent? Should it be defined by genetics? It's a lot that is yet to be determined as far as how that plays out. So just to try to get to some of the general points here. So one point, we always look for synergy to what we're talking about during the week in the parasha here. This is not exactly synergy, it's just a very rough connection. But, so, in the same vein as the question of why all these animals are listed, so here, when the Pasuk says, Kol tzipor tahoru tachelu, skip to a second Pasuk at Aleph, so we went through fish, now to go to birds, so what exactly is the message of that Pasuk? So the Sifrei says, okay, it's a mitzvah saseh, it's telling you what to do, that these are the ones you should eat. But what does that mean, practically speaking? The Rambam lists that as a mitzvah in Kufnun, in the Sefer HaMitzvos, and he says that it's a mitzvah to clarify what is and what isn't kosher, to go through the process of figuring it out, even though when it comes to the birds, so we don't have such explicit symbols, we have to derive them from the Klalim. And as he writes in Mishneh Torah, in Hagos Machalos Asuras, that essentially there are four qualities that seem to emerge as what defines a kosher bird. Three of them are physical aspects of what it looks like, and one of them is that it's not dores. It doesn't prey on other animals by using its claws to pierce them and to poison them. So that seems to be the set of rules as far as figuring out what it is. And the Rambam writes that this is a mitzvah saseh, but the Ravid and the Ramban disagree, and they say there's no reason to count this as a mitzvah if you don't want to have any birds, and then there's nothing you have to do. But if you want to eat birds, so then you're going to have to figure this out. So it's a slight synergy to yesterday's discussion, the question of what constitutes a mitzvah, what isn't a mitzvah. Can you say that if this is something you could theoretically live your life and ignore, it's only going to be relevant if you're interested in pursuing a certain activity, so should that be counted as a mitzvah or not? But in any event, so there is this set of kolim to try to figure out what is a kosher bird and what isn't. And it's a big question, how well can we use that formula to try to decide if you come up with a new bird? So how do you know? So that's a tricky thing, and therefore it says in the Shulchan Aruch, and also in the Ramah, this is in Tei Beis in Yerodea, and the Ramah is in Sif Gimel, and the Mechaber is in the previous Sif, they both convey that in addition to everything else, you really need to have a Mesorah, you really need to have a tradition to know what has traditionally been eaten in order to ascertain what birds are kosher and what birds aren't kosher. Now, that itself is a mysterious term. What exactly is considered to be a Mesorah and what isn't a Mesorah? Does it mean that you have to have a personal Mesorah, or is it enough there's a Mesorah somewhere in Klal Yisrael? What about birds that could arguably be considered related to other birds? So does that need its own Mesorah, or is it enough that it has that kind of a connection to a bird that we do have a Mesorah on? So one of the major focuses of this question is the question of turkey. So is turkey considered to be a kosher bird or not? As you're probably familiar, there is quite a literature on that and quite a difference of perspectives on that. And what exactly is the relationship to turkey goes to this question of what kind of a Mesorah do we require in order to satisfy the standard of having a kosher bird. Just to mention one idea here, so one of the birds that's identified as not kosher in Pasuk Yitches is the Chasida. And you may think Chasida, it sounds like a beautiful name, sounds like Chesed, and there are many righteous Jewish women with the name Chasida. So why is that a non-kosher bird? So if you recall, Zarashi and Shmini, that tells us that it's called Chasida because indeed of Chesed, she'osa Chesed im chavrusa, that it does Chesed, it acts with kindness to its friends. So the question is, if that's the case, that's not what you would expect from a non-kosher bird. That seems like that should be a good bird. So very often you hear people say Divrei Torah that, well, the problem is it does Chesed but only to its friends. And that's why it's not a kosher bird. So I hate to be a spoilvort, but I don't think that's enough to explain it, because if it does chesed, the fact that it's limited, so we're all limited, and that's essentially reality. And if you learn the halachas of chesed, so there are priorities and there are realities to how much chesed you're able to pull off. So to say that a bird should be not kosher because it does chesed but the chesed is limited, so that seems like a surprising conclusion. So I think really the point is something else, that it's not kosher because the chesed is limited. It's not kosher because it's a predator. And the fact that it does chesed, the chiddush is, that doesn't change it. So I think that's the point, that the chesed is not enough to make it kosher despite the fact that it is a predatory bird. So we shouldn't think that just because chesed is limited, that makes it non-kosher, because that's not reasonable. We all are limited in how much chesed we can do, and that's understandable. But the more relevant point, you know, it's like the Nazi who was nice to his mother. So yes, he could do acts of chesed, but if you're a predator, if you're a murderer, so it doesn't help that you also have chem chesed in your life. And I saw that my grandfather wrote a commentary to the Torah Tumim in Parsha Shmini. I think he says along those lines also. So Baruch Shekivanti, I think that's really the mahalach, not that the fact that the chesed is only to its friends. Okay, that's one thing. But the point is that the chesed is there, but it's not enough to override the fact that it's a predatory bird, and therefore it is in this category that is considered to be not kosher. This next pasuk also talks about shratzim, v'chol sharet sa'ov, tamei hu lachem, lo ye'achelu. And Sefer HaChinuch has a comment here. This is also evocative of the writings of the Rambam. Again, another reference to the Sefer HaChinuch and the Rambam often saying similar things. So here, part of the hashkafa of kashrus, it's tricky. There's a lot of theories as to what exactly is the basis for kashrus and why certain animals are prohibited and aren't. So nowadays, it's often suggested by those who want to dispense with the mitzvahs, who don't want to follow the Torah, to say that it was there because of health recommendations. And nowadays, it's not an issue anymore. Nowadays, we can control this. So we certainly don't accept that as a basis to change the halacha. But it should be noted that the Rambam does say something similar as far as the basis for it. Not that it's something we can change as much as that, but that he did write that there is an element of health considerations that the Torah is taking into consideration. And the Sefer HaChinuch writes here in similar lines that the Torah doesn't want us to hurt our bodies, and these are all consumptions that could be dangerous. And then he goes on to write that, and even if the doctor's going to tell you, so here certainly to emphasize that it doesn't mean that it's a halacha that can change, says even if the doctor tells you that there's no problem here, you shouldn't listen to them, because the Torah is much smarter than any doctor. And he goes on to say that that's why the Torah doesn't connect it to that officially, that even if that is the reason, but the reason the Torah doesn't identify this as connected to considerations of health is because you might think, okay, well, I know better, and therefore I'm not obligated to follow that. So it's just told us as a chok, and it's a permanent halacha, even though it may still be true that there is some connection to its implications for health that is part of the mitzvah. All right.
Do you think that's why the pickle, when they become kosher, because like maybe at a certain point the health concerns are no longer concerns, and therefore that's also a reason that they can return to being
kosher? It's hard to know, because there's so many moving parts in that explanation that it's hard to know how exactly to process that. I guess no pun intended. But, so what exactly is that based on? It could relate to your previous question. Is it because Simanim will be different? Is it because some reality will be different? Is it because the Teva of the animals will be different? It's also a discussion if we're saying that the animals that are dangerous are treated differently, animals that are violent or predatory are treated differently than animals that aren't. So what if their character, so to speak, changes? All of that is a part of the discussion. It's beyond us, but it's a fascinating thing to speculate about.
Hi. Not like Chas Shalom disagree with what they say, but what health benefits? Like,
so we don't know, and that's also what the Sefer HaChinuch writes, so we don't understand it, and we're not expected to understand it, but that the Torah is telling us this in order to protect us from whatever implications it has, and that's what he's emphasizing, that we don't know, and the doctors may not know, and you shouldn't listen to them, because they don't know everything that the Torah knows, and that's also why it's not being spelled out that way, so we shouldn't think that, okay, we can just deal with it.
See, but we have the ability to see physically, like, we don't know, but how
the Chinuch is, now clearly not all the Rishonim are going to agree that this is even the issue, but those who are arguing this is the issue is saying that there's that which we don't understand, and which certainly that part is believable, the idea that, you know, if you follow nutrition, so you see that every week there's a complete reversal from what the previous week said. So the idea of what is and what isn't healthy is certainly something which it's easy to believe that doctors, even of the greatest qualifications, may not necessarily have a total picture of. So, but that's essentially the way the Chinuch articulates it, that you may think that you totally understand this, but you don't, so therefore you should submit your understanding to the Torah, but also to prevent even that path of thinking, it's why the Torah doesn't spell this out as being a motivating factor. Presumably, because also a part of it, putting that together, is that even if that is part of the story, it's not the whole story. So even if we could account for that and correct for that, it still wouldn't be a reason to change the din, and therefore not to give a pistol and pat to that, I guess, again, no pun intended. So that's also part of that explanation why it's not something that's going to be spelled out. Caleb, you
I was saying that I've actually encountered this before. There was, I was one time at a day camp years ago when I still lived in New Rochelle, and there was a kid who said, "Wait, you keep kosher too?" And I said, "Yes, I do keep kosher, I'm Jewish." And he said, "Well, I'm not Jewish, but I mostly keep kosher because of its health benefits."
So, you know, it's a part of it, but also another reason why there's a perception nowadays that kosher food might be healthier is just simply because somebody's paying attention. So, you know, if you have supervision and you have rules, So then at least you know certain things aren't going to make it. Nobody wants to know how the hot dogs are made, but the kosher hot dogs, somebody has to know how they're made, so therefore you can at least rely on that, where when it comes to the non-kosher hot dogs, then really nobody may know how they're made, and anything literally could end up in there. So when it comes to kosher food, you can assume there's at least some limit. So that is, and certainly the population of those who keep kosher in America is higher than the population of observant Jews. So it's clearly that's something that's been pointed out extensively. There's a lot of literature about this, about why kosher supervision is such a big business. That's definitely a part of it. But it doesn't necessarily connect to this, because it doesn't necessarily mean that they're subscribing to the belief that pigs are somehow more dangerous than cows, but just the fact that there is some kind of supervision.
And it's more expensive, so
yes, anything that's more expensive is better. Right. There's clearly that going on also. So here, there's also a fascinating, really fascinating discussion here. So in addition to telling us really so many of the laws of kashrus are here, we know there are all kinds of rules of kashrus. So when it comes to eating animals, so we know that there are minim tmeim and minim taharim, that there are certain animals just that we can never eat, no matter how they are prepared. So that includes the whole list of animals that are just simply non-kosher. But then when you have a kosher animal, so then it's still not automatically going to be mutter. It has to be shechted properly. And it has to also not be unhealthy in itself in a way that disqualifies it. So that is what we call a trefa. If an animal is somehow sick in a way that would cause its death, and the various categories how to define that. But even if it's not a trefa, so you have to go through all these tests. You have to make sure it's a kosher animal first. So let's say you figure out that it's a cow and not a pig. And then when it's a cow, you have to make sure it's not a trefa, which maybe you'll figure out afterwards, but that's part of the process here. And then if you have a cow, it's not a trefa, so it still has to be shechted properly. So if it's not shechted properly, so it's a nevela. And that's also referenced here in this aliyah, the prohibition of not eating a nevela. So here the pasuk says, lo sochlu chol nevela. You're not allowed to eat a nevela. But a nevela is mutter behana. You're allowed to benefit from a nevela. It's different than bas b'chala, we'll talk about it in a second. So la ger asher b'sharecha titnena v'achala o machor l'nachri. So here, what can you do with it? There's no prohibition of hana. So you're allowed to give it to ger toshav, to a ger asher b'sharecha. Rashi describes here the ger as a ger toshav shekibel alav shalav v'nazar v'ochon levelos. And so here, ger now, we doesn't mean ger in the sense of a convert who is obligated in all mitzvot. It means a ger toshav, so he lives in Eretz Yisrael and he's accepted not to worship idols, but he's still allowed to eat non-kosher foods. He's allowed to eat nevelos. So you should give it to him, or you can sell it to a nachri. So here, it's interesting, there's a whole literature about this, because there's a din in Shulchan Aruch, in Kuf Yud Zayin, that you're not allowed to do schora with non-kosher food. So even though there's a difference in terms of what's asur b'hana and what's not, so basur b'chalav is asur b'hana, chametz is asur b'hana, but other kinds of non-kosher food, not necessarily asur b'hana the way we assume. So chazer is not asur b'hana, but the nevela is not asur b'hana, but you're not supposed to go into business as a nevela seller. To do schora with dvarim hasurim is considered to be a prohibition, but there is a heter within that prohibition of nizdamim lo, that if it just turns out you're not looking to become a dealer of nevelas, but you end up with a nevela, so then you are allowed to sell that. And they point out that that's what essentially it says in this pasuk, that you can see that there is a scenario where you could have a nevela in your possession and you're allowed to sell it, even though you are not doing that regularly. So it's not supposed to be your major source of parnasa, but if you end up with a nevela, it's damilo, so you are allowed to sell it. So here, just to clarify, this is itself a Pesach to a whole different discussion, because the assumption is that the prohibition of schor b'dvarim asurim, of selling non-kosher food that's otherwise not prohibited b'hana, but this prohibition of business specifically, is assumed to be a prohibition midrabbanan. It's a rabbinical prohibition. So how do you bring a proof from a pasuk that it's mutter? It could be that it's mutter min haTorah and it's prohibited midrabbanan. So why is this relevant at all? So this is actually very significant because the Taz made this famous, so to speak. I'm saying it's famous because David Cohen uses that language. He wrote a whole sefer about this Taz called a Taz Hayadua, the famous Taz. So what's so famous? The Taz has a chiddush, but it's very possible that this is a principle that Rishonim had also, that even though we know there's a notion of dinim d'rabbanan and that the rabbis can create new prohibitions that are not in the Torah, but they can't prohibit something which is explicitly permitted by the Torah. So they prohibit things that are not covered in Chumash. It's not mentioned one way or another, and we would have thought it is mutter because it's not mentioned as being prohibited. So the rabbis have the authority to prohibit those things. But if the pasuk itself tells you that it's mutter, so then they don't contradict the Torah. So they can't prohibit things that are identified by the Torah as permissible. Aye.
Then how can they prohibit shofar and lulav on Shabbat?
That's a great question, and the short answer is, the Torah never says specifically blow shofar on Shabbos. The Torah says blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah. And Rosh Hashanah will often not fall out on Shabbos. So we can figure out, by the fact that the Torah doesn't say Shabbos is an exception, that by Torah law we should blow shofar on Rosh Hashanah even if it's Shabbos. But it doesn't say that. So therefore, if the rabbis to come and say that Shabbos is now going to be excluded from that is not contradicting the Torah explicitly. But had it said specifically, even on Shabbos, that'd be a problem. And some understand that's why they didn't prohibit bris milah on Shabbos, because that's derived from an explicit drasha that you can have a bris milah even on Shabbos if it's the eighth day. So maybe that's why we don't have a prohibition of bris milah, but shofar and lulav, we do. So there's a lot to say about this, as you can imagine. But it's not even the subject, but it's just a necessary introduction, because otherwise this whole discussion is hard to understand. If this is a din d'rabbanan, so why are we looking at the pasuk to figure out the rules? So this is one of the contexts. This Taz comes up in at least three or four times in Shulchan Aruch and different Chalakim in Shulchan Aruch, and this is the one in Yeridah. In Yeridah, the Taz is talking about this din, that you can figure out what's included in the din that's a din d'rabbanan based on the pasuk, because if the pasuk allows it, so then we know that Chazal wouldn't have prohibited it. So apparently we can figure out this rule, for example, of Nizdamin Lo, that if it's something that just happened to show up in your possession, it wasn't your intentional business, so then that's exception here to this rule of not doing commerce with something that is prohibited. So coming from that perspective, so then there's discussion about other details. So the Taz also writes that if you are allowed to sell it because it just ended up in your possession, you can sell it to another Jew and then he can sell it. Because it's all an extension of this idea of Nizdame. It's not just that you have to sell it to a non-Jew and then that's the end of it. So he says, how do you know that, the Taz? Because you see that when it comes to giving it to a ger, so it says, titnena, you should do it, you should give it to a ger. But when it comes to selling it, so then it just says, machor, not saying that timkor, not saying that you have to sell it. It sounds like anyone can sell it. So it's, that's the difference, that even if you received it just by circumstance, you can sell it to even another Jew, and that Jew can, l'chadchila, buy it from you and sell it to somebody else. That was the position of the Taz. And there were others who disagreed, Abach and Chasam Sofer as a tshuva, and he says, no, that's not the diyuk they're supposed to make. So the reason the pasuk has this difference in language of titnena when it comes to the nevela to the ger, and machor when it comes to selling it to a nachri, is because the giving it, that's a mitzvah, that's tzedaka. So therefore, the mitzvah you ideally want to do yourself. So the Torah is phrased that way, saying that you're going to give it because you're going to give it as tzedaka. But when it comes to selling, so that's not a mitzvah. Okay, so theoretically you could have a shliach do this on your behalf, but it doesn't mean that the heter of nizdamin lo is going to change once it moves to a third party. Very interesting deal. The Meshech Chachma on this pasuk, so he does accept this idea that Nizdamin Lo would carry even to the next Jew who could buy it from the first Jew, and he could still sell it. But Meshech Chachma says there is a limit, that once it reaches the hand of a non-Jew, so then that's it, or once it reaches the ger, so then you can't sell it afterwards. So he says that's the language of the pasuk here. It says the va'achala in the middle. So it says that you give it to a ger, and he eats it. Or you would sell it to an acher. So once it reaches the hands of the ger, so then you can't sell it afterwards. And he says that that's the intent of the pasuk of Yachala. And similar to the Chasam Sofer, with a different application, he says, because that's the whole point here, that you should use this to sustain the ger who could benefit from it. So if once that's the case, once he's able to benefit from it, so then there's no heter anymore to sell it after the fact. So that was the way the Meshech Chachma concluded on this point. In the footnotes, Meshech Chachma, written by Rabbi Cooperman of Machala, so he has just an interesting comment there. He says, you see, from this comment, he's very impressed by this comment. He says, you see, the power the author of the Meshech Chachma had, the author of the Meshech Chachma was Rabbi Meir Simcha Cohen Advinsk, who also wrote the Sefer on the Rambam, the Or Sameach. Says, you see, his ability to paskin based on just the pashut pshat of the pasuk, you can figure out the proper halacha based on the language of the pasuk. You see what a great posik he was. He has that footnote over there. He says, you see how he is figuring out how to derive this halacha, how to apply this halacha based on that pasuk. Okay, so just a few more words to say, and then I guess we'll daven mincha up here. So then the aliyah ends with one of the most well-known halachas of kashrus that is completely different from everything we've seen so far. So we've seen the animals that are kosher and that aren't kosher, and bugs, and the issue of nevela. All of that is one thing, but the last thing in the pasuk here, last thing in the aliyah, is a phrase that appears three times in the Torah, lo sevashel gedi b'chalei vimo, that the prohibition of basu b'chalev, that we can't mix meat and milk. And this appears indeed three times in the Torah, and the Gemara derives from that that even though it's always in this language of Bishul, but it translates to three Isurim, that we're not allowed to create the connection of meat and milk through Bishul. And that's a whole discussion, what exactly qualifies as Bishul and what doesn't. But and every detail here, a little similar to yesterday's discussion, again, very weak synergy, but every word here is subject to definition. What's gedi, what's chalev, what's levashel? So what constitutes a real creation of a connection between the two on a level min haTorah is an interesting question. But on the surface, what emerges is we have three prohibitions. We can't create the connection. We can't cook the two together. Once that happens, we're not allowed to eat it. And basu b'chalev min haTorah, whatever really qualifies as basu b'chalev, is also subject to a prohibition of hana'ah. We're not allowed to benefit from it in any way. So there's a lot, as you can imagine, to discuss. We're not going to get into the details now, really, over time. We're not going to get into the details of Bishul Basu B'chalev, but just some points to note. So first of all, it's an interesting question what the Iker Isser is. If the language of the Torah is Lo Sevashel, is that significant to convey to us that it's really all comes from there, that the Isser is Bishul, and the prohibitions of eating and benefiting are a consequence of that? That's a possibility, and some connect that to the pasuk that we mentioned earlier in the Saliyah of Lo Socha Kol Toeva, that which is considered to be abominable, that which is considered to be prohibited, you shouldn't eat. So maybe that's the way it works. I'm not supposed to create this connection. And if you have this connection, then as a result of that, there's an isser to eat that connection. Or is it the other way around, that maybe there's really an isser of eating basu b'chalev, and the Torah says not to cook it because that could lead to us eating it. That's how the Kesef Mishnah understands in the Rambam, that he thinks that this is what you would call a siag min haTorah. That really the actual focus of the Isra is we shouldn't eat basu b'chalev. And in order to make sure we're not going to eat it, so we shouldn't even create it. That's how the Kesef Mishnah understands the Rambam. And the idea that there are Isurim in the Torah that are really there just to protect other Isurim of the Torah. So that's a notion we've mentioned in the past, was made famous by Rabbi Yosef Engel, died 102 years ago in Poland, a great Talmud Chacham, and he collected a list of all the dinim in the Torah, which he thinks are really there as a safeguard for other dinim in the Torah. So one of his items on the list is Bishul Basu B'chalev, because he thinks, based on the Rambam, that the real Isser is eating it, and the Torah prohibits cooking it because it can lead to us eating that which is created through the cooking. And others understand the other way around, that really the Isser is the cooking, and it's prohibited to eat as a result of the fact that that was the problem. So there's a lot of speculation among the Rishonim as to what is the reasoning for the Isser of Basu B'chalev, whether it's focused on Bishul or whether it's focused on Achila. So on the one hand, this is kind of the paradigmatic chok. This is really something which we presumably don't understand so well, and that's how Rabbeinu Bachya and others understand that there's something here that's mysterious, and this really represents the idea of ritual halacha that is beyond our understanding. Others come at it from a different perspective, perhaps at the opposite extreme, is the Rambam. The Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim has a statement which was controversial to some because it could also, even more so, lead to one thinking it doesn't have to be relevant anymore, which is, of course, not the case, but that one could theoretically allow themselves to think that. So even more than the concern of unhealthy food, the Rambam associated it with a idolatrous cult that used to worship through the mixture of meat and milk, and because we want to be distanced from that idolatrous practice, so therefore we're not allowed to do this either. And it suggests that that's also maybe why in the Torah, the three times it comes up usually in connection with the Moedim, as we're going to find here also. The Torah is not going to tell us about all the festivals throughout the year, so the notion that there are certain times of the year when there is particular focus on worship, and this cult would worship through the practice of mixing meat and milk. So in that context, we're reminded that's not for us. We don't mix meat and milk. We're not allowed to do that. Others understand, not necessarily a contradiction to this, but maybe it's related, that there's just an incompatible mixture similar to shatnez. And shatnez, of course, is also something that's difficult to understand. It's probably a hope. But that maybe it represents the mixture of life and death, that milk comes from milk and meat both come from a cow, but milk comes from a living cow and the meat comes from a dead cow, and therefore the ability to mix the two is a problem. Bringing the two together is an unacceptable kind of kilayim, similar to shatnez, and maybe it's prohibited for that reason. Other Rishonim suggest that the Rashbam, for example, says that this is just gluttony, that you have to eat the whole cow together, you have to eat the milk and the meat together, so it represents a certain type of rafsanusa, of gluttony, and that it's similar in its nature to osov yespino, that the same way that you're not supposed to shecht a parent and a child animal on the same day, so too to eat the milk product and the meat product together is a problem. And the Ibn Ezra understands that it's because, possibly, right, it's maybe a lie, that it might be because of Achzarius, that perhaps the language of the Pasuk is the way it is, because maybe that's the real ikker of the Isser, that really, what's the prohibition? The prohibition is literally what it sounds like, to boil a kid in its mother's milk. So that's something that cultivates a certain kind of cruelty. So, okay, you have to eat the animals, so we have come to grips with using animals for food. But it's not just that you're eating the animal, but you're going to take the animal, and in order to cook it, you're going to boil it in its own mother's milk. So that's already achzarius. And as the Rishonim explained, it doesn't mean that we think the animal's going to suffer more because of that, but it's just the image it creates in you is one of complete insensitivity to what's going on, so it cultivates a certain kind of achzarius. So according to them, the Ikar Isser really was not just meat and milk as extrapolated from here, it really was about the animal in its mother's milk. But lemaisa, we can never know where the milk comes from, where the animal comes from, so therefore it's translated to an Isser of all meat and milk mixed together, but that's how he understood that it's rooted in that concern that you would be doing literally what the Pasuk says, you'd be literally boiling this animal in its own mother's milk. So there's a lot of discussion here, clearly a whole range of interpretations as to what is the Tami HaMitzvos of Basu B'Chalav. But it's also interesting that the Aliyah ends with the same note that it began on, or kind of began on, Ki Am Kadosh Ata, you are a holy nation. Rav Schwab has in his Sefer and Chumash that he thinks that this is a way of emphasizing that this Isser somehow connects to our Kedusha as a people. And therefore, that's why there's such Chumrah associated with it, that we find that there are many Dinim Drabanan that are associated with Basu B'Chalav, and that we really treat it as very Chumrah. So, for example, we've extended it to fowl rather, we've extended it to chicken, that we're not allowed to eat chicken and milk, and we have many other Dinim Drabanan, the whole notion of waiting between meat and milk. All of that reflects that there is a tremendous Chumrah that Chazal have used to relate to Basu B'Chalav. And if you learn Kalabasar, as we did here a few years ago, so you'd see it's also a little bit surprising just how many Dinim Drabanan are piled onto this din. And the Gemara has to discuss what is a Gezeira L'Gezeira, what's already too many steps on top of things, because we should have limits to how much we can add on to a Diman HaTorah. So clearly Chazal related to this with a great Chumrah, even though, as Rish Rab notes, it's not Nisr Karis. So sometimes if you have a Nisr Karis, so then there are a lot of safeguards that are built on to save us from the Nisr Karis. But here, Bas V'chal, is a lot, it's not Nisr Karis. But the Torah is conveying to us, he suggests, with this language of Am Kadosh, that this goes to our Kedusha as a people, and therefore we are particularly sensitive to it. So again, it's very striking that we have this prohibition here, ending off this Aliyah with that message again, and the whole Aliyah is framed with the message of our Kedusha. And what we have found with all these dinim is that in many ways our Kedusha is affected by the dinim in this parsha, the concern that we have a cohesive nature as a people, that we are able to be unified and that we're able to live in harmony. The idea that we do not have extreme reactions that suggest we are disconnected from the comfort of being connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, who is our Father. And the fact that we have this discipline in how we eat, which contains so many different messages, whether, as some statements in Chazal suggest, it's really all about the discipline, whether it's about some kind of a concern for our well-being that is beyond what we are able to understand, and we trust in the Ribbono Shel Olam's love for us as far as that's concerned, and all of these many different themes that we see contained within Basa B'Chalav, whether it's about avoiding Achzarius, whether it's about avoiding mixing that which is incompatible, whether it's about a recognition that HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows what we don't know, and that we allow that to define our behavior. And indeed, Basa B'Chalav has perhaps more than many other mitzvahs really come to define the separateness and the unique nature of the Jewish people. So in that sense, the Kedusha and the fact that the Jews are set aside as a nation that trusts in God to guide them and to give them the rules by which they live. So Basa B'Chalav really has taken on in practice a role for that message that is very powerful. And everything in this Aliyah all reminds us of what it means to be a holy nation that is distinct and that is unified within itself and that is able to convey a cohesive message to the world. So with that, we will hopefully bring inspiration into Shabbos, and we shall lift us up as we listen to this powerful Parshas Re'eh. And I look forward to seeing you sometime on Sunday. Stay